Hello, and welcome to another edition of the LinuxQuestions.org podcast. First up, LQ updates. Just one quick LQ update for this week's podcast, and that's that I'm happy to announce that my blog now supports OpenID. Now, I'd recently upgraded my blog to WordPress, and it took a little while to get everything moved over, and permalinks are finally working again, and the first enhancement I'm doing now that things have kind of stabilized is to support OpenID. Now, as I announced a little while back, the LQ Wiki also recently became an OpenID consumer, and this is part of our current OpenID evaluation, and we are looking at eventually implementing it on the main LQ site. And if we did it there, it would most likely be as a server and also as a consumer. So we'd actually offer you an OpenID and also consume OpenID. So if you've run into any issues or you spotted a bug either in the LQ Wiki implementation or on my blog, please do let me know. And if things continue to look as good as they do so far, the LQ Radio site will probably soon also support OpenID. Now, onto the news. The first story I have is the Torvalds transcript. Why I absolutely love GPL version 2. This was from a recent Information Week article, and it delves into how Linus feels about the GPL version 3. This is a topic I have covered on the podcast before, but this interview has a couple of new good quotes and some good explanations from Linus. And this is from the article. Quote, Linus, first off, I don't even know what the GPL version 3 will look like. I would be totally crazy to accept a license for my code sight unseen. I think people who just say version 2 and any later version on their code probably don't care about their license of their code enough. Before I say that, yes, you can use my code under license X, I'd better know what that license is. So that's an issue totally independent of any particular GPL v3 details. The reason Linux has the GPL v2 only language is exactly that I simply don't want to be at the mercy of somebody else when it comes to something as important as the license I choose for my code. So, I can't even imagine why anyone would ever expect me to do anything but v2 only. It's just stupid to do anything else. Now, totally independent of that, I'm doubly happy that I long since made that decision because at least the drafts of the GPL v3 have been much worse than the GPL version 2 is. They've had glaring technical problems, license proliferation with not just one single GPL version 3, but GPL version 3 with various additional rights and various additional restrictions. And while I certainly hope that the final GPL v3 won't have those obvious problems, I've been singularly unimpressed with the drafts. Finally, the real basic issue is that I think the Free Software Foundation simply doesn't have goals that I can personally sign up to. For example, the FSF considers proprietary software to be something evil and immoral. Me? I just don't care about proprietary software. It's not evil or immoral, it just doesn't matter. I think that open source can do better, and I'm willing to put my money where my mouth is by working on open source. But it's not a crusade, it's just a superior way of working together and generating code. End quote. As for myself, I've also never really understood the quote-unquote or any later version clause either. You're basically implicitly trusting whomever runs the FSF in perpetuity, and that just seems like a really bad idea, to me at least, and regardless of whether you trust RMS now or not, like I said, that's kind of an in perpetuity thing because it's always and or later, so it could be up to GPL version 10 or whatever was ever released under that name. And here's another quote from Linus from the article. Quote, so the FSF and I really don't agree on some very fundamental things. I absolutely love the GPL version 2 because it embodies that develop in the open model. So with the GPL version 2, we had a thing where everyone could come around it and share in that model. But the FSF seems to want to change the model, and the GPL version 3 drafts have not been about developing code in the open. They've been about what you can do with the code. To go back to the science example, it's like saying that not only should the science be peer-reviewed and open, but you also add the requirement that you cannot use it to build a bomb. End quote. Matt Asiat also commented on this article, and he put it well when he said the following. Quote, we need to be careful about trying to thwart all future wrongdoing with present understanding. It's just fraught with difficulty. End quote. And it kind of does seem to me like the FSF may be trying to do a little bit more with a software license than they should be. But that being said, the GPL version 2 has just been a spectacular success, so they clearly know what they're doing. Now, I'm really hoping that the next draft clears a lot of these issues up. My one big fear here is that the recent Novell Microsoft patent deal may make the FSF even more ardent in some of their sections and some of their wordings. They've already come out and said they're going to try and prevent things like that deal. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, but it's going to depend on how they go about that. So we're definitely going to have to wait and see what the next draft looks like. The next story I have is Living and Dying with Linux in the Workplace. This is another look at a person documenting an attempted switch to Linux, and I covered one of these a couple podcasts ago, but I think some of these are really, really interesting. This time, it's Sharon, who's Computer World's online managing editor. The article really is a very educational read, and it comes down to some of the same things it has for a while now. Linux is ready. For users at both edges, the switch will almost certainly be almost entirely painless for you, and you'll find yourself with a better system, a more stable system, a more secure system, and probably a more functional system in no time at all. But if you're in the middle, and by the edges there, I mean a very technical user or a user who doesn't use very much at all, a very simple user. In the middle of that, you might find an app that you depend on that simply isn't compatible with Linux, or some kind of procedures you have or scripting that you've done that just isn't going to directly port over, and you're going to have to do some significant work, or something's just not going to work. And in many office environments, that middle user can make a carte blanche switch to Linux kind of non sequitur, at least in the short term. And the one thing that keeps coming to mind with these is that when you've been in the Linux world a long time, it's easy to forget things like this. And I think it's really good to get steady reminders, especially if you're producing Linux, but even for people like me that I don't directly make any Linux distributions, but I've been using Linux so long and solely pretty much so long that it is easy to forget sometimes. And one of the things that it does to hear these is it frames things in a useful manner, and it really just keeps you grounded. So here is Sharon's conclusion from an article that was in Computer World. Quote, "I expected to be a poster child for the next wave of Linux desktop adopters. I wanted to be. I liked the whole idea of technically macho open source operating system, one that doesn't assume we all must be protected from the operating system and its inner workings. I don't fear command lines, and I enjoy fiddling around with programming. It turns out that an intermediate level power user may not be the next ideal desktop Linux demographic. It was possible for me to do most, but not all of my work on a Linux system. There are some applications I'd miss if I were to make the switch permanently, but I believe I could adequately replace them after sufficient research and time rewriting scripts. There are a few other applications I definitely need access to from time to time and that wouldn't run on Linux. I could probably deal with these either by virtual machine windows or by a separate Windows machine shared by multiple users. Don't laugh, that's what our copy editors did for a while, since they're all on Macs and some initially wanted to access an ActiveX control feature of our content management system. Other business users, workers in sales, finance, or human resources for instance, might also find the applications they depend on don't easily translate to Linux. They may find workarounds, they may not. While I liked many things about my Linux desktop, the look and feel, the elegant command line implementations, robust open source apps, the whole open source concept, I found the lack of some key applications and the occasional hardware non-plug-and-play too limiting. Unlike Scott on Mac OS X, I'm not willing to tell Microsoft bye-bye. Not yet, anyway. But there's enough here I like that I'm going to keep Linux system set up, too." End quote. And I think that is a pretty good conclusion in some ways. A lot of these things are being worked on, but for instance, one of the applications that she brought up is one that I continually see, and that's Photoshop. And you do have some options. If you're an advanced, regular Photoshop user, people often throw out there just use GIMP. I don't necessarily think that's a good answer. The GIMP is a fantastic program, but it's certainly not an answer for a power Photoshop user, at least in my opinion. Some versions of Photoshop do run, say, in CodeWeavers, OpenOffice, or even Wine. I don't believe the very latest version works, and in her case, she wasn't actually using the whole Photoshop. She was using Elements, and it wasn't supported. So there are definitely some issues, and at this point, one of the good things is it's mostly just application issues. The plug-and-play stuff, I'm not sure what specifically she had problems with. I haven't had any hardware not work in Linux, even wireless networking, in a long time now. there are some particular things that might not work if you don't just do a cursory glance and look for the couple of glaring things that don't work. But as long as you avoid those, we really are down to application support now, and I kind of see that as the last leg, but it's a good thing to get these reminders that we're not quite there yet. The next story I have is Connected Diversity. And this was a post that Jono made on his blog, and it's a somewhat subtle but really important observation that he made at a recent CBIT. And here's a quote from his blog. Quote, "What was particularly interesting was how Ubuntu, and as such Linux and free software, is becoming part and parcel of people's lives. If anyone walked past the booth, we would grab them and pester them about Ubuntu, and a huge number of people who walked past seemingly paying no interest were already using Ubuntu. Most of these people were simply not all that excited about it. It is the OS they use, and that was the end of it. This shows that Ubuntu is becoming a real operating system. People are using it and not automatically becoming all singing, all dancing community Linux fans. It's becoming a norm and part of the furniture, and this is good news. Of course, it would be great if they all did become community members, but the reality is that a percentage of the user base will become contributors, and to see so many using it in a regular end-user scenario is extremely encouraging." End quote. Now, this is actually something that I've been noticing as well, and it's more of an indication to me about the mass adoption of Linux than any eWeek article or analyst report from Forrester or Gartner or whoever will ever be. When 100% of your users are hardcore evangelists, it probably means you have a really great product, but it almost certainly means you haven't reached a certain scale yet. Because in the end, on anything that becomes mainstream and has a really wide reach, 100% of the people just don't become hardcore evangelists like that. People, quote-unquote, just using Linux is an indication to me that we really are ready, and the time really is now. No. I'm not going to say that this is the year of Linux on the desktop or anything like that, but it's clear that a couple of things that have needed to come together for a little while now finally have come together, so this is going to be interesting times ahead. And this kind of segues into the last article I'm going to cover this week, and that's Red Hat Plans Linux Desktop Offering for the Masses. So like I said, speaking of Linux on the desktop, it looks like Red Hat is getting back into the desktop Linux market. And here's, this is from the article. Quote, "Red Hat is planning a packaged Linux desktop solution that it hopes will push Linux desktop offering to a far broader audience than exists for its current client solution. This will be more comprehensive offering that will target markets like the small and medium-sized business sector and emerging markets. Part of this strategy is to get the desktop more to the masses than our existing client is getting today. So there will be a different package solution for the masses coming down the pike." Asked if part of the strategy is the mass consumer market, Pornia responded that Red Hat has no plans to go and sell this offering at Best Buy, if that's what you mean by the mass consumer market. Consumers will be able to download it and get a Red Hat Network subscription on the web for it, which is what we feel is the distribution wave of the future anyway, he said. End quote. Now, I've always thought that Red Hat was missing a pretty important part of the market by not offering a maintenance but no support option. And that's basically what Red Hat Linux was, obviously. And I've said this a couple times, both on my blog and on the podcast before. Now, for my part, I still maintain that Fedora is not a viable option for the average Linux user. If you're a developer, it's not bad. And in fact, I use it on both my main home desktop and my main work desktop. But, you know, the initial rollout, kind of in retrospect, was pretty poor. The packaging paradigm just keeps changing. And I don't mean this at an RPM level. They have always used RPM and Yum. But, you know, the core plus extra flips that have been going on, and at first there was no extras, and there was extras, now they got rid of extras. It's just, if you're not really an enthusiast that wants to spend time on this, that flip's been taking far too many cycles. And the upgrades often break things. And with Fedora Legacy gone, the upgrade cycle is, I think, too fast for the non-enthusiast. Now, I don't think that this means that the project isn't doing an absolutely awesome thing. They're doing a ton of really, really cool work. I just think that a lot of people try to do with Fedora things that they shouldn't necessarily do. And mainly, in my opinion, that acts like it's Red Hat Linux, because it's not. It has a pretty specific purpose, and if you use it for that purpose, it's really good. But if you try to do things with it that they're not meaning you to do, I think you're asking for trouble. An interesting side note here, if you can believe it, on the LQISO site, Red Hat 9 is still one of the most downloaded distros, and I think that speaks volumes. Now back to the article, it was a little bit light on details, but I'm looking forward to seeing what the product actually entails. But if it is a case where you can get maintenance, no support, I think it's going to be a really interesting product that probably does really, really well. Now, on a kind of side desktop note, I had been meaning to try SLED and a couple of the other desktop AIM distributions for a while. I've heard some great things about them. Just really, one thing, I haven't had time, but the patent deal kind of threw me off a SLED specifically, but hopefully I'll get a chance to try a couple of these soon. I know they recently announced a Service Pack 1 at BrainShare, so now might be a good a time as any for me to try that. And speaking of BrainShare, if you haven't seen the Mac Guy spoofs that they Novell did, look them up. I'm sure they're on YouTube, or they're probably also on the Novell site. They were superbly done and pretty funny, so do check those out. That's all I have for now, but thanks for listening.